Welcome to a special hour of Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Yesterday was Thanksgiving, and for those who observe it, it ushers a time of year marked by a great deal of eating and perhaps drinking. So today we are dedicating a full hour to all things food. And boy, is food all the things. We will give you pumpkin to talk about.
For pumpkin seeds, my big suggestion is once you get them out and you clean them, to put them on parchment paper, not paper towels, put them on parchment paper and leave them out overnight.
But if squashes aren't your thing, how about something absolutely different?
The diversity of apples is really half of the joy of apples. And the more you dive into it, the more that whole world opens up to you and feels very exciting.
Plus, here to complete the fall trifecta of flavor, some favorite maple-flavored cocktails.
Normally, the old-fashioned, you could save it for after dinner, around the fire, or Monopoly, or just after the nice strong drink. Yep.
And you can taste that good. Nice little touch of maple syrup.
Yeah, exactly. really kind of takes the edge off. And that orange zest, that does really make it pop.
Yeah, totally. It's added a little citrus brightness to a drink that normally wouldn't have it.
And just like that old-fashioned, we'll talk about cocktails at the end of this hour. But fun aside, food and drink are also complicated. For many, the holidays are a reminder of what's missing in the kitchen and beyond. And the need this year is larger than ever. United Way of Massachusetts Bay and Merrimack Valley reported distributing meals to 18,000 families ahead of this holiday through their partners. It's the largest ever distribution of Thanksgiving meals in the more than two decades the organization's been doing so. And it's not just concentrated to the holidays. The American Red Cross of Massachusetts says it's serving record numbers of patrons at its Boston food pantry this year. So let's begin today by checking in with those who are food insecure, with Catherine D'Amato, Executive Director of the Greater Boston Food Bank. We spoke with Catherine as the food bank was preparing for Thanksgiving, and we started by asking her who she thinks about during the holidays.
I think that the piece that sticks out is that there is, first of all, gratitude when there is help, when you are able to go to a local pantry in your community and receive enough food for your family to celebrate a holiday and to have been able to have celebrated Thanksgiving and or the holidays ahead. So it often doesn't look like what you think, and it's families who are struggling around not having enough income. They might have a sick child or they're caring for an elder parent. And of course, with COVID, we all know that the tragedy and trauma that families have faced during this time includes a lot of loss of job, loss of family, loss of resources. So when you can reach out, whether it's this past Thanksgiving or going forward into the December holidays, it makes a huge difference for a family.
Who are these families? Are they, what is the face of hunger in Massachusetts?
Well, in Massachusetts, it's very much like the national numbers. It's 1 in 8 and 1 in 6 is a child. For Eastern Mass, our numbers are a little bit better. It's 1 in 10 and 1 in 9. It's a very hidden situation. I mean, it's an epidemic, but it's hidden. I mean, you can't walk down the street and say, okay, that one's hungry and that one's not. That one goes to a pantry, that one doesn't. That one's on SNAP, that one isn't. And so this is a very silent epidemic where people have a great deal of dignity, but a very great deal of embarrassment. And we know that, you know, half of who we serve often doesn't even go to seek out federal assistance like SNAP or WIC or school programs. We have to do better than that.
How do we do better? And I really want to zero in on what you said about dignity and embarrassment. How do I, you know, having, you know, in my career earlier, been at food distribution, done this work, thinking a lot about dignity and pride and people's need for support, but doing that in a thoughtful way that supports their humanity. How can we do that better?
We have to make it normal that it's okay. That's okay to ask for some assistance, whether it be through your local community program, your local food pantry, your church, your synagogue, your temple, whether it's being on SNAP. I mean, a lot of work has been done to help with that, you know, getting rid of the paper. You know, you remember when we had paper SNAP kind of dollars and what they were called, you know, food stamps, right? And now it's really, it's called SNAP. It's about nutrition, WIC. It's all on an electronic card, which looks like everybody else's, you know, credit card or debit card. So it normalizes it. It's okay to seek help. And we have to be able to make sure that people are welcomed. They come for so many reasons. Again, loss of job, a sick child, an aging parent, not being able to have your housing, being in shelter. There are so many reasons where people find themselves needing help. We have to be able to say it's okay, and that's why we're here. And one of the messages that we try to put forward at the Greater Boston Food Bank is we are here to help you. This is okay. It's okay to seek out this help. And how do we get you to have enough earnings, to have stable housing, you know, to have a healthy family so that you don't need this resource except for some period of time in your life and you can move on, but make sure that it's there for everyone who may need it next.
Will you work at a food pantry or go to a food distribution center during the holidays?
Yes. Many of our team members and myself included will make time to be at our crosstalks or our direct distributions with school-based programs or veterans programs or our healthy mobile markets where we can be there to help, to pack bags, to pack boxes, to lift turkeys, to, you know, empty trucks, to make sure that families have the bountiful meal. You know, when you are able to do this, especially at Thanksgiving, it's very humbling, both for the person that's giving the food and for the person that's receiving the food.
Maybe take us to a school-based program. I want to imagine that. So at a school-based program, what gets distributed? How does it happen? Is it the kids that pick it up? Is it families that pick it up? Is it in a box, a backpack?
Sure.
Tell us about that.
Sure. Our school-based programs happen in two ways. In some cases, it's imagine the cafeteria or the gymnasium. And in some cases, it's the parking lot where tables are set up and there's food all along those tables. And families of school children, because it's a lot of food, come through on at a certain time and they're able to pick and choose what they like or what they want. And, you know, so not all families eat the same foods. So if you don't like squash, but you do like sweet potatoes, right? You don't have to take the squash. It's really a choice. And sometimes they're put together, right? Where there's boxes put together, pre-boxes, and they hand them to families, but they have all of the Thanksgiving foods in it. What you and I would normally see, you know, some kind of a turkey, poultry, some kind of, if it's only a couple of people, it might be, you know, chicken parts, ways in which families can address the size. There are things like potatoes and squash, and there are, you know, green beans and carrots and onions and all of those things, as well as some desserts, right? Some ways to be able to bring that pleasure for families as well. But it's very heartening. And I think it, for me, as somebody who's done this work a long time, it's important not to lose that North Star, that compass of why we do this work. You know, we can get very much involved in running the work or making sure the food gets in and out, but going and working with families and talking to them, you know, having a cup of coffee or a cup of tea with them while they're getting their food, it's incredibly humbling.
What's your North Star, Catherine, in this?
My North Star is that food should be available to everyone who needs it. And our families are not able to provide for themselves due to perhaps an economic condition or their zip code or their, you know, situation that they were born into or their opportunities were not given to them in the same way. So how do you make sure that that food is available and that it's healthy? Look, I grew up in, my grandparents were farmers and my parents were in the restaurant business. And at a very young age, my father taught us to bring the people in that knocked at the back door, begging to work for food, to bring them in, sit them down and feed them, and that they were never to work for that food. That's a very telling experience as an 8-year-old, and it has stayed with me. So people need to be able to have access to food, to housing, to employment. It's such a basic thing.
Will need be bigger? Will you serve more people this year than last year?
We will. And we, you know, we plan to do 23 million meals during this holiday season, sort of from mid this time through the end of the year. And we have seen huge growth. I mean, COVID clearly brought in numbers of people who had never been to a pantry or never sought help before. And yes, things are improving, but we're still seeing 600,000 people a month getting some type of food from the Greater Boston Food Bank.
Do you remember, and you might not, but do you remember, I mean, that 600,000 number boggles my mind. Do you remember 10 years ago what that number might have been?
Sure. Well, we've seen that number grow substantially. So I think one of the best ways is pre-COVID, it was 1 in 13. You know, now we went as high as 1 in 3, you know, in terms of when you had 30% at the height of COVID of our state seeking some kind of assistance in some way. So over my lifetime as a food banker, I've seen those numbers come and go, whether it's due to inflation or whether it's due to an economic recession. You know, these, you do see it ebb and flow. The key is that the number shouldn't exist. We want people to be food secure, not food insecure. We'll give out 40,000 gift cards at $40 each to families at pantries so they can not just get the food that they're getting at the pantry, but they'll be able to go get some other things that they want, that they need.
Are you feeling the same squeeze from, you know, both sides of supply chain issues and inflation, and how's that affecting costs for the food bank?
We have seen an increase between 10 and 20% on the cost of food. What we have seen here, significant delivery delays and the increased cost together. So we're able to get the food that we want, but it is a little bit different food. We may not get cranberries because there's a shortage of aluminum, things of that nature. But we don't expect that food costs are going to improve in 2022. So many more of our neighbors will be needing our help, and we're going to continue to provide it.
So you've said before $25 feeds a family. Is that still the number?
Yes, a gift of $25 can provide a complete holiday meal for an entire family. You know, and we're grateful to companies like Stop and Shop and the Biogen Foundation who have, you know, matched up and come forward to help us raise $1 million to meet the goal of 23 million meals.
And what do you need most right now, Catherine?
Well, it's always these three things. It's money, food, and time. Those are the three things that make our work go, and we need financial resources in order to acquire and distribute the food. And we need the care and understanding of individuals, whether they volunteer with us or whether they show up at their local community or whether they write a check. We all have the ability to do something. Everyone has a role in ending hunger. Everyone has a role in making Massachusetts a food secure commonwealth.
And what's going to fill your cup this holiday season?
Well, this year I'll be able to be with my family. Last year there was a lot of distancing and they lived out of state, so we didn't see them. So we'll be able to check in on Rhode Island and Delaware this year, which matters a great deal to me. And I think that is the way to be able to feel good that there's love for each other, but also hopefully we'll feel good that we have done our best here at the Greater Boston Food Bank. And a huge thanks to the team here at GBFB that has stayed present and visible and working every day.
All right. Catherine D'Amato, President and CEO of the Greater Boston Food Bank. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
That was Catherine D'Amato, Executive Director of the Greater Boston Food Bank. Coming up, we will switch gears to gourds. Stay tuned. I'm Tiziana Deering. You're listening to a special hour of Radio Boston. Welcome back to a special hour of Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Today we're looking back on some past conversations about food. Before the break, we talked with Greater Boston Food Bank about food insecurity, which is especially prevalent during the holidays. Now, we turn in a different direction, the opposite direction, really, to some conversations we have had celebrating food, specific kinds of foods, in fact. And during the fall, arguably, one reigns supreme.
Just think, Sally, when the great pumpkin rises out of the pumpkin patch, we'll be here to see him. What's that? What's that? I hear the great pumpkin.
That's from It's the Great Pumpkin, Charlie Brown, and Linus is right. Our great pumpkin is coming up with an excerpt from a conversation we aired this fall about pumpkins and pumpkin carving. In it, Marissa Covo, field manager at Shelburne Farm in Stowe, Massachusetts, and Joe Gatto, local chef, culinary instructor, and host of From Scratch on Pluto TV, break down some tips and tricks for roasting pumpkins and their seeds. But first, you will hear a call from Ruben, who had a creative recipe for flan.
Hi, yeah, thanks for taking my call. Several years ago, I wanted to kind of combine a holiday favorite of pumpkin pie, which, you know, we're just so sick of the same old pumpkin pie recipes. But I wanted to combine it with one of my other family traditions, which, you know, my family's from Puerto Rico. We do a flan baked in caramel. So I got a fresh pumpkin, I roasted it, and I hung it to get the water out, and combined it with my grandmother's flan de queso recipe, and to kind of boost it up a little bit, rather than, you know, no crust, which flan usually has no crust. I made a hazelnut de quoi, which was nice and crunchy, and then we served it with some candied orange peel to give it a little bitter zing on top. And it was definitely a winner that season.
That's fantastic, Ruben. Thank you. And, you know, if you get a chance to tweet at Radio Boston the recipe, if you'd share it, I understand if it's sacred, but if not, tweet it to us because we would love to have that. So let's get into cooking for a minute. And Marissa, I'm actually going to come back to you. Many different kinds of pumpkins, is that right? And is there some kind, like if you're going to eat it as well as carve it, is there a particular kind you ought to be looking for?
Yeah, most definitely. So in terms of the baking pumpkins, most people usually go for a sugar pumpkin, which is usually a smaller one. It's more sweet in flavor versus the larger pumpkins that you typically use for carving. However, you can still eat the larger pumpkins. It's more of like a sheet pan sort of a thing where you would bake it similar to what you do with butternut squash. But most people tend to go for the sugar pumpkin for baking.
Mm-hmm. And that flan sounds great, Joe Gatto. What else do you love to make with pumpkins?
I want to make that flan now. I'm going to Ruben's house.
Yeah, I know. So, sounds really good.
Yeah, I actually put up for NPR today. I sent over my pumpkin soup recipe. So it's a roasted pumpkin soup with fried sage leaves and toasted pumpkin seeds.
It sounds incredible.
It's really, really luxurious. I love that soup. It's simple. I love that it's so fall and just the deep, rich flavors with the crunchy little pumpkin seeds, and that fried sage just adds that little oomph. That's a really good one. So they'll have that up on the site so people can try that for this. I think this Thanksgiving, why not? Give it a shot.
Yeah, we'll have it at radioboston.org. So two quick follow-up questions on that. One, is it easy to burn sage if you're frying it?
I mean, if you're not paying attention, I would definitely suggest not tweeting or Facebooking or Instagramming. You know, just pay attention to what you're doing and get the oil, you know, at medium heat. And throw them in, they'll fry really quick. The water comes out of it, so it splatters a little bit, but not too much. But they fry in like 30 seconds a minute. You just drain them on paper towels, and it's really incredible. The fried sage is awesome.
All right, and then my other quick question is, how long and at what temperature do we roast the pumpkin seeds?
It really, for pumpkin seeds, my big suggestion is once you get them out and you clean them, to put them on parchment paper, not paper towels, put them on parchment paper and leave them out overnight. They dry out, and when you roast them, they roast much better because it's not having to get all that water off, and you get a much crunchier pumpkin seed. We just did it on Saturday, worked like a charm, and then we all watched Poltergeist.
Awesome. So still, I really want to know temperature and time. So I've left them overnight on my parchment.
We ended up at 325, and it took about 25 minutes, and you constantly want to be stirring them.
That's Marissa Covo, field manager at Shelburne Farm in Stowe, Massachusetts, and Joe Gatto, local chef, culinary instructor, and host of From Scratch on Pluto TV on all things pumpkins from earlier this month. You just heard some tips and tricks for cooking and roasting pumpkins. But if gourds aren't your thing, what about another fall fruit?
It's apple pies that make the men folks' mouths water. Pie made from apples, like me.
Oh, they do look delicious.
Yes, but wait till you taste one, dearie.
a clip from the movie Snow White, of course, right there. But we promise the recipes and tips in this revisited conversation will not provoke the fate of Snow White for you. Guests Amy Traverso, senior food editor at Yankee Magazine, the author of The Apple Lover's Cookbook, and the co-host of Weekends with Yankee on PBS, plus Ben Clark, fourth-generation apple farmer, owner of Clarkdale Fruit Farm in Deerfield, Massachusetts, take us through the ins and outs of apple baking, apple picking, and even apple cidering.
We grow over 60 varieties of apples, and everything from the clip you play, we grow the russets, Roxbury russet, going back to the original first cultivated variety in the U.S. from Roxbury, Mass. In 1635 up until Evercrisp, which is one of the newest varieties available. So we full range, and like you said, I mean, you can do eating, baking, drinking, anything with them.
So are you just wanting to cheer, Amy, as you hear Ben listing all these varieties?
Yes, it makes me so happy. I mean, I love Ben's farm. It's a gorgeous spot with really great quality apples. And yeah, the more and more orchards have been, you know, ripping out their Red Delicious patches and putting in more interesting, whether it's new varieties like Evercrisp, Honeycrisp, and Cosmic Crisp, although I think that's rolling out more slowly, but or putting in the antique varieties like Roxbury Russet and Northern Spy. It's just the diversity of apples is really half of the joy of apples. And the more you dive into it, the more that whole world opens up to you and feels very exciting.
Okay, so Ben, two questions at once. One, all these apples called crisps, are they like actually crispier? Is that why they're called crisps? And what's your favorite variety of apple as a fourth generation apple grower?
Well, I can answer both of those in one question. So in one answer. So the one of my favorites currently is Crimson Crisp. Amy referred to Cosmic Crisp, which does get a lot of play out in and it's been a big marketing campaign, and that's only grown in Washington. That's a whole nother segment on apple rights and everything. But anyways, that's a whole different thing. But Crimson Crisp, there's a whole series of crisp apples. And like anything, it is about marketing. You know, obviously a Macintosh can sell itself. That's been around for hundreds of years. Everybody knows Macintosh. It's a fine all-purpose apple. But there's, as Amy was saying, there's all these new apples coming along. The next best thing everybody wants to get in on. And so there's been a whole push on, and the name is, you know, Evercrisp is a great name. Honeycrisp, obviously people know. But Crimson Crisp it's an earlier apple. But they store well, very crispy, slightly tart, and just amazing eating flavor. And that's what I say is basically people always ask me, what's my favorite apple? It depends on the season, what we're picking, what's fresh. So apple fresh off the tree, as anybody knows who's been apple picking, that's always tastes the best.
Before I go to the phones, Amy, I'm going to go to Twitter to at Schoon Carrington, who said, yes, I will be tuning in to take notes on Honeycrisp apple recipes. Let's go. So, Amy, you're up. Honeycrisp apple
okay.
recipes.
Well, this is a great opportunity. Okay, so here's what I want to say about Honeycrisp, because Honeycrisps are very expensive relative to other varieties. So, yes, they actually really do well in any kind of long cooking dish like a pie or crisp where you're baking those apples for like 45 minutes or an hour. Honeycrisps hold up well. They have a great texture. They bring a nice like sweetness and acidity to any dish. However, you're paying more for that pie. I would argue that, and I'd love to hear Ben's thought on this, the Jonagold to me, which is a much less expensive apple, it's an older variety, has a lot of the advantage, the same like assets of the Honeycrisp in that it holds up well. It's got that sweet tart balance, but it's a lot less expensive. It dates back to the 1950s and it's just not as fancy as a Honeycrisp. So Honeycrisp in pretty much any dish cooks well, but again, like you're just paying more for that kind of name brand quality of the Honeycrisp.
So I was today years old when I found out that apple is pronounced Jonagold and not Jonagold, which is what I always thought it was. What do you like Honeycrisps in, Ben? And, you know, Ben, I hear you just came off of pressing and bottling cider about 15 minutes ago. So maybe tell us which apple makes the best cider, too.
Sure. So, well, the quick answer on the cider is we do a mix, and we always find similar to, and Amy could may agree on some of this, is when you're making a pie, also it's nice to have a mix of Johnny Gold, and certain varieties are good single variety, but you can also, if you mix a few, like we do a pie mix, which is Northern Spy, Greenings, Cortland, Johnny Gold, and it really has a nice balanced flavor and more complexity. And the same with our cider is we like to do at least five or six varieties. And just like the clip you played, is the earlier ciders generally are more on the tart side. You have the earlier apples that they are more tart. Once you get into what's called more the dessert apples, which is like the Honeycrisp, basically meant for eating out of hand. You know, that's what we're getting into. Johnny Gold is a great all-purpose eating baking cider. And I would agree, just what Amy said was we steer people when they come in and they want to, everybody loves Honeycrisp. They want to make a pie. They say, oh, I want a Honeycrisp pie. You know, the Johnny Gold, I actually, and a lot of growers would agree that we prefer the flavor of the Johnny Gold. It's a little more, a little more tartness, like a little more balance. It's not just a one note sweet. And it is an excellent all purpose apple.
All right, we're going to the phones. Shoshana is on the line in Roslindale. Shoshana, go ahead.
Thanks so much for taking my call. I'm a huge fan of your show and the station. I wanted to put a plug for apples being a beautiful way into learning about trees. If you haven't yet read The Botany of Desire, a wonderful book years ago by Michael Pollan, the section on apples is completely eye-opening and amazing. Just remembering that, of course, apples were planted here as cider, not as fruit to eat fresh in the early parts of the colonial history on this continent.
Thank you, Shoshana. And Amy, I'll come to you there because some of this you track in the Apple Lovers Cookbook.
Yes. I, you know, when I started working on the book, I assumed that when the first pilgrims arrived, the shore was probably lined with apple trees. And in fact, only crab apples are native to North America. And the apple really did make its way from Asia through, you know, the Greek and Roman empires and up to Britain. And that's how it made its way to the U.S. Those apples, just as Michael Pollan described and as I described in the book, grew in these fruit forests. If you imagine the Berkshire Hills, but rather than being covered with birch and, you know, maple trees, covered with fruit trees. And so travelers would pick up the fruit on their way and bring it with them. And apples are very portable. They're also very resilient and very able to interbreed with local crab apple trees. So basically they can grow almost everywhere. I mean, they actually, there's even a variety of apple called Tropic Sweet that was bred at the University of Florida. So in northern Florida, you can grow apples, not so much in the tropics, but, you know, apples are just incredibly, are able to thrive in an incredible number of climates. And so that's how they made their way here. And as Ben said, you know, the earliest American apple that we still grow is the Roxbury Russet. And when you are eating a Roxbury Russet, you are eating a cut it, because of the way we breed apples, we need to basically clone them by grafting branches onto trees. So when you're eating a Roxbury Russet, you're really eating a cutting of a cutting of a cutting of a cutting, going way back to that first tree, which I love.
So I want to pick up on trees. As I do, I'm going to acknowledge, Amy, you also talked about colonialism, right? You talked about with everything we talk about, there is a history. There is a history of race. There is a history of colonialism here in the U.S. with most things, at least, that we talk about. There is a history of bias and origination. And we've had conversations on this show before about whether apple picking always feels accessible to families of color and families from urban neighborhoods. And I want to give the nod to all of that in this context. And I'm glad that you brought it up. We also have Shoshana's point about trees. And Ben, one of the things I did want to ask you about, we had a crazy summer and the weather, it rained hard in July. We had heat. How has that affected the apple crop?
Sure. And actually, just looping back to Shoshana's question and talking about, you know, the taking your son and having, you know, this history. So being the fourth generation on our farm, we have trees that were planted by my great-grandfather back in the 1920s, and they're trees that we still have, large size mac trees that were the original tree that I climbed when I was a kid, and now my children, who are 5 and 8, are climbing on, and we have families, you know, like a lot of people going apple picking, anywhere that you go, it's a multi-generational experience. So it's, you know, somebody grew up going there as a kid, now they're taking their kids back. grandkids, bringing grandchildren, and it really is a nice memory. And, you know, getting a picture with a lot of places will have a big apple with that says Clarkdale. You know, people will have their thing, and you see the kids growing. So it's really nice for us as growers, and the connection to the community is seeing people coming back every year. But anyways, getting back to your question, so we had a dry summer early and then a wet summer. And the thing, fortunately for apples, is, as Amy said, they are very hardy. It is a tree and the fruit is grown off the ground. A lot of things, pumpkins and other things, had a poor year because it was such a wet year and fungus issues. We did deal with that, some of that with apples, but really it's been a bumper crop for the most part. I mean, we didn't have a frost in the spring, and then the water basically helped the trees grow. So they're really healthy. And then it's a really juicy, wonderful flavor on the fruit this year. So we're still harvesting, and we'll actually be harvesting for another 3 weeks.
All right, Amy, I'm not going to have time to go to Rhiannon in Dedham, but the question, how do apple pick on a budget? What options are available? What varieties do we go for where?
That's a really interesting question. I mean, I think that, so picking apples on a budget, you're going to have different price points for different varieties. Ben, I'm not sure, if you wanted to just quickly speak to
I could just say something. One thing I could say, which the state, and you probably have talked in this program before, is for certain people, I don't know what budget exactly, but one thing in terms of accessibility and affordability is, so apples and a lot of orchards are participating in the SNAP program with the state. And actually, there's a HIP matching program, which ourselves and other orchards participate in, where you actually get free funds for fresh fruit. And apple, pick your own apples are eligible. So you actually, in terms of anybody who's in an assistance program, it's a great program.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Well, so we're light on time. I appreciate that, Ben. So, Amy, I'm going to tweak the question for you. The most versatile and affordable apple, like the one that sits in that Venn diagram?
Well, I want to go back to highlight the Jonagold, because it is a less expensive apple than the Honeycrisps and the newer varieties, but it gives you a lot of the same qualities. And actually, I think, like Ben, tastes a little bit better. If you love Honeycrisp, I would say try a Pink Lady, which is also less expensive. It's been around longer. That's one way you can go. There are orchards that you could access by public transport if you don't have a car. For example, Russell Orchard, you could take the commuter rail and then take an Uber. And there's lots of information about that online. So
Excellent.
You could look for that too.
Excellent. Amy Traverso, senior food editor at Yankee Magazine and author of the Apple Lovers Cookbook. And Ben Clark, owner of Clarkdale Fruit Farm in Deerfield, Massachusetts, and president of the Massachusetts Fruit Growers Association. Amy and Ben, that was fun. Thank you.
Thank you
very much.
That was Amy Traverso, senior food editor at Yankee Magazine, author of The Apple Lover's Cookbook, and the co-host of Weekends with Yankee on PBS, plus Ben Clark, fourth-generation apple farmer, owner of Clarkdale Fruit Farm in Deerfield, Massachusetts, in a conversation that aired in October. Coming up, we end the show with the question, neat or on the rocks? You're listening to Radio Boston. Welcome back to a special hour of Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. On this day after Thanksgiving, we've been talking all things food, from what it means to be food insecure to celebrating two fall food favorites, pumpkins and apples. Our time together is just about up today, so we'd like to end with a digestif of sorts.
Are you an old-fashioned?
We're on the same mission. This bar looks like it was set up by a blind man. And there's no bourbon.
Rye okay with you?
You look like you know what you're doing. I'm Connie, by the way.
Don.
That is Don Draper, played by John Hamm from AMC's Mad Men, making his signature drink, an Old Fashioned. An Old Fashioned is also the first drink of our next conversation, a revisit from 2 years ago when we could all be unmasked in Studio 3 together. Now, we understand that for some, alcohol is a social drink and associated with fun, but for others, it causes addiction and loss, and we are mindful of that as we bring you this conversation. here are Radio Boston's Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, and Zoe Mitchell, who were joined by Lonnie Newbern. Lonnie is the owner and operator of the Boston Shaker, a craft cocktail supply store in Somerville, Massachusetts. In the conversation, we dive into a handful of cocktails, all with one special ingredient, maple syrup.
Yeah, we're going to roll on something sweet. We do have some maple syrup here. We got some great Vermont maple syrup from our friends at Cask Force. They're a local Boston company, but they're aging it in bourbon and rye barrels. So we're hoping that mixes up well with our nice dark rum and a rum old fashioned. We're using one bottle today to make two cocktails, keeping it simple for the holidays.
Beautiful.
Old fashioned Manhattan, still the holiday classics around the family table. People are mixing up their kind of strong drinks for after dinner. So for this one, we're going to feature a local rum. We got Medford rum from Grand 10 in South Boston. And we're going to build this in a mixing glass. We got a couple of friends. We want to make at least three old fashions so we can all sip on them. So it's nicer to have a little larger vessel to stir them up in.
That's what I like to hear.
I love old fashions.
Go big or go home, right?
This cocktail comes from one of the new cocktail books. It's actually Nightcap by Kara Newman. She's a great New York cocktail writer. And her cocktail is called the Flapjack Old Fashioned. It uses 2 ounces of an aged rum. Again, we're going with the Medford. Mm. The maple syrup here is going to add that nice sweetness. We're only doing about 1/4 ounce per cocktail, so it's a pretty sweet one.
It smells so good.
Oh, yeah. Very fragrant.
I feel like I need to waft
it's going
to
make it super decadent.
Yeah.
So I'm a big old-fashioned fan. I feel like they're kind of having a moment. Are they having a resurgence?
Is during the holidays, the shaker's full of people making great cocktail gifts, but the one that comes up a lot is the old-fashioned. It's the iconic cocktail, very simple, spirit, bitters, and sugar. This time we're going to be rolling in something different for the sugar, the maple syrup. So easy to make and fun to do around the holidays. I got my ingredients in this big mixing glass. I'm going to add some bigger cubes here. They're going to take a little longer to melt, and they're going to allow me to stir this cocktail for about 20 seconds is what I'm looking for.
All right.
So I got a big mixing glass. I'm going to take my spoon, get to the edge and all the way down. And I'm just going to stir this at a nice even pace by twisting and kind of pulling to really melt that ice and chill down, mix and dilute our cocktail.
Really
the old fashioned
so
is one of the strongest out there. So a little water goes a long way. I'm going to stir this about 20 seconds, and then I'm going to use a strainer. I'm going to strain in these old-fashioned glasses. We got some fun ones here, the pineapple cut glass from the shaker.
Can you use any glass for an old-fashioned?
You can, you know. Some people like it on the rocks. Some people like it neat. It's really up to the user at that point. I'm going to take this big one out.
So you said you're using the Medford rum. What in particular about that rum?
It's an iconic one. Honestly, back when Boston was a huge rum producer, we were doing blackstrap molasses-style rums. This one's definitely from that original blackstrap molasses. And then it's got a real funky, kind of rich flavor. So it goes well in stirred and shaken cocktails. So we're going to be using that for the old-fashioned here. Then we're using that for the shaken cocktail later on.
Beautiful.
To finish this one, a little orange peel or like a zest goes a long way. So I'm going to do a peel of orange, just taking the swath here, and just pinching that orange oil over the top. It's going to make this rich drink a little more decadent. Add a nice little orange aroma. If you want, you can go ahead and do 2.
So would you add a cherry to this one or no?
Certainly. You could do, if you prefer the cherry, like in your Manhattan, your old fashioned, the cherry garnish is also iconic. So here you are, guys, our first cocktail.
This
is the
icons.
Flapjack old fashioned.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, give it a swell. Cheers.
Cheers. We're kind of far away from each other. But...
yeah. So we're starting off rich.
There you go.
Normally, the old-fashioned, you could save it for after dinner, around the fire, or Monopoly, or just after the nice strong drink. Yeah.
And you can taste that nice little touch of maple syrup.
Yeah, exactly. really kind of takes the edge off. And that orange zest, that does really make it pop.
Yeah, totally. It's added a little citrus brightness to a drink that normally wouldn't have it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
So we said old-fashioned's kind of having a resurgence, but I feel like maple is also having a resurgence.
Yeah.
I've seen that
in a few
different
cocktails.
We're pretty
fortunate on the East Coast. Yeah. As a substitute during the holidays, it's so decadent. This one especially, having that nice kind of warm bourbon kind of caramel flavor. Really can add it to, you know, pancakes, but it goes great in cocktails as well.
Maybe so, pancakes with the cocktail.
Yeah. But Cask Force, they're out of South Boston. They're doing a great job.
So we had you on in the summer, and you did some summer cocktails with us. I'm curious, what makes a great winter cocktail or a holiday cocktail in your eyes?
Bringing in those allspice flavors, you know, we use a lot of the maple. We're going to be using the Montenegro here for the next one. Nice caramel, kind of clove and cinnamon flavors. You know, like you're drinking the holidays, really.
And I was saying, I love, you didn't bring to these, I love cranberries in my holiday cocktails.
Oh, yeah.
I've been making cranberry margaritas. So.
Yeah, totally.
Really good.
I do. The glass gives it a nice classy feel, too.
Yeah, it's really nice.
Non-paper.
There.
Right? Yeah. Exactly. Right out of Mad Men.
Split ones. Again, this one, let the ice talk to it while it simmers there. You know, it's a stronger one, but you know, you have to like full glasses. This is one of the original strong cocktails, yeah.
So Zoe is the producer who did some research coming into this and actually found out that the Old Fashioned is the world's oldest cocktail.
That's correct.
And apparently, like, what else did I learn? I learned that it's the oldest cocktail, and yeah, that Don Draper is part of the reason it's had
certainly.
This
yeah, you can watch him kind of make a classic Old Fashioned. Back then, they used a little bit of soda water and kind of he does the Boston Chop, if I remember, which is a interesting stirring technique. Okay. But in the end, it boils down, yeah, spirit, your bitters. In this case, you would use like an Angostura bitters, which is like an allspice, and the sugar.
What is the Boston Chop?
Boston Chop is when you take a spoon in your mixing glass, and instead of stirring elegantly, you just kind of chop at it.
Oh,
so you're going for it.
So not
we've got
elegant.
Some original.
Yeah. I didn't know that there was a name for the different stirring.
This town
techniques.
Has a lot to be proud of. That is not one of the most.
That's not really something to be
proud
of.
Although for the next one, I'm going to be using the original Hawthorne, which is like a no-prong. So this is invented in Boston, 1895. So we've got a lot of cool like inventions coming from our town. And the next one is actually a shaken cocktail that really features one of Boston's favorite drinks, which is a daiquiri.
All right.
And even though we're in the winter season and a daiquiri is kind of a light, bright, shaken drink, it still does perfect with winter when you pair it with things like cinnamon syrup. And in this case, we're going to add a little Montenegro.
I'm very interested in this one because you say daiquiri. I'm thinking tropics, laying on the beach.
Yeah, the daiquiri timeout is welcome. It's a simple cocktail to make. It is one of those shaken drinks, but it's simple ingredients. We've actually taken a recipe from Drinking Like Ladies. This is a great cocktail book from two local authors. You got Kirsten Amon and Missy Kalfakin, both awesome bartenders in Boston. And this drink is actually comes from the principal bartender drink, Ezra Starr. So this is one of her cocktails coming from Drinking Like Ladies.
Right?
Yeah, Drinking Four Point, one of the best cocktail bars in the world.
Yeah, absolutely. I noticed both the books that you've brought, you got your recipes out of, they come from women. Is that something
that's correct.
You're trying
Kara
to do?
Newman out of New York.
Yeah.
And both Misty and Kirsten are great authors. We've got kind of featuring a lot of the famous women behind in history and also behind some of the best drinks out there. So,
great.
We're drinking like ladies.
Let me
today.
Say cheers to the women writers.
I'll drink to that. I'll drink to that.
Enjoy your cocktails. I'm going to get started on the next one. This is a shaken cocktail. So this one has citrus. Anytime you have citrus in a drink, you do want to wake it up, shake it up. We're going to feature the same rum, the Medford rum. This is a nice, again, aged rum. So it goes in white American oak barrels. We'll get to it. More of a caramel flavor, which when you're making a shaken drink, using aged spirits is great to get that kind of like allspice, kind of darker feel. So this one's pretty simple. This is 1.5 ounces of rum. And I'm just going to pour this right into our Boston shaker. I'm going to double this up for you guys.
Whoa.
Yeah, you'll be all right.
So what makes that a Boston shaker, just that we're in Boston?
Yeah, originally a Boston shaker was a glass on tin. I'm using like the tin on tin here. But these were kind of a Boston invention. Originally the tins were manufactured here in Boston. So when they went abroad into Europe, they would say Boston on the bottom. So we actually got the name from across the pond. But yeah, this is what we get our name at the Boston shaker. It's the iconic tool. It's the only one you need to really shake and stir at home.
All right.
So we got our rum in there. This one's going to be lemon juice instead of lime.
Again, is it fresh squeezed lemon juice?
It is. I have it right here.
Nothing but the
one
best,
of the rules
of
we have a takeaway in our classes is always use fresh ingredients, especially when it comes to citrus. It makes your cocktail brighter, and it's going to be much more enjoyable than like buying that kind of concentrate.
And you guys are really big on local too, right?
That's right. Yeah, actually got this cinnamon syrup from a local restaurant, Spoke Wine Bar. They're down there in Davis Square. They really helped us out. This is a nice allspice cinnamon syrup, so it's going to make this cocktail have that nice kind of baking spice as well. So we got our rum, our lemon juice, our simple syrup. And to make this one a little darker, and again, we're following the recipe, Montenegro is an excellent amaro. It's kind of like a bitter. This has a nice orange and kind of caramel flavor. So we're just doing equal parts of the sugar, the Montenegro, and the lemon juice with 1.5 ounces of rum.
So is this when would you drink this? Is it after drink?
Honestly,
is this
we kind of did reverse.
Whenever?
I would do this before. It's
okay.
Like an aperitif. You know, it's bright. It's light. It's got a little cinnamon, but it's going to get your palate ready for dinner. I'm taking the Boston shaker.
It's coming up, so do it now.
I'm giving a flat edge to it, so I'm not lining up straight. And I'm giving a nice love tap. That'll make an initial seal, but when these tins get cold, it'll create a vacuum. It'll really hold this together, so you don't have to hold it too tight. My dominant hand on top, left hand on bottom. I'm just shaking up to my shoulder and down, kind of creating this motion. If I want to go faster, I just shorten my stroke, and now I'm in business. I'm shaking for about 10 seconds. You can count
you
in your head, or you can feel
music
it coming through the tin.
It's not sound, though.
You want to get this cocktail nice and cold.
So why does it matter how you shake it? You can wait till you're done.
Oh, you're in control of the dilution. You know, you want to shake it, wake it up to blend everything, really froth it up, aerate it because there's citrus, and in the end, get it down to that right balance with water. Most cocktails are about 20-30% water, so At home, focus on shaking for 10 and stirring for 20 seconds, and you'll get a nice, cold, balanced drink. Don't short your shake there. So this one, we're going to serve it up. A daiquiri is usually served up in like a coupe-style glass. So we got some nice coupes here. These are the Leopold ones we carried to the shop. They're nice little tasting coupes, so they're not huge. So it's kind of a nice hosting cup if you're just having a lot of people come in. You can make two drinks and split it between multiple people.
There you go.
So here we go.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Wow.
Thank you.
This is going to be our holiday daiquiri. Again, this is coming from Ezra Star.
So what would you call this?
Well, actually, I should say it has a proper name. This is Elements of the Star, coming from Ezra Star at Drink in Four Point.
Cheers.
Yeah, cheers, guys. So this should have some darker notes.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, you like that?
Oh, I love it.
Do you guys get notes of cinnamon?
That's
exactly.
This is great. So, Lonnie, I'm from North Carolina, where it's a little warmer than now, and just a drink feels warm.
Yeah.
So, thank you. It's been warm in the right way, not in like that like Christmas. It's cold
Christmas
outside,
in July.
Warm inside, warm.
It's good anytime, you know. Again, we kind of winterized this one from this recipe, but a daiquiri is a great, easy-to-make cocktail anytime, whether it's tropical, warm, or just trying to stay warm during the holiday.
That's right.
So what's your favorite holiday cocktail?
Honestly, I do. We reach for the old fashions. I'm certainly going to be using some of this maple syrup at home. I do like a Negroni. And we had thought about doing another Negroni cocktail that's equal parts gin, sweet vermouth, and Campari. But you can really add a lot of changes in flavor by just adding some bitters. And again, like an orange twist over the top of that. So a nice Negroni is also like a great holiday cocktail.
And Lonnie, if someone like, I don't know, someone out there listening to me on the radio wanted to buy me a gift.
Yes.
For making one of these cocktails.
Whoever you may be.
Yeah, just hypothetically.
We certainly have everything you need to find at the Boston Shaker, your friendly neighborhood cocktail supply shop. We're right in Davis Square. We are on the web, thebostonshaker.com.
But what are they going to get me?
Oh, you know what? For you, I would think like an old-fashioned syrup, some maple syrup here. You can mix that with a cool ice tray so you get those large cubes. And maybe a spoon to stir it up.
Wow, you know me. You know me so well. Yeah.
I'm curious, though, because I love to do that. Walk into a cocktail specialty place and say, surprise me.
Oh, totally.
What do you kind of think about when you're trying to figure out?
Well, we ask questions about, like, you know, what they enjoy spirit-wise or what their experience with cocktails. We have things from everything from beginner to, you know, we work with a lot of the professionals in the city. So just their experience and background, and we kind of lead them to the right solution.
Is there a trendy drink in Boston right now at this time of year?
Yeah, this time of year, again, we're a daiquiri town, so that's good any time of year. I would say if you look around some of the great craft cocktail menus, they're doing a lot of things with shrubs, some really interesting house-made ingredients. So any bar you walk into, see what they're working with.
All right. Well, that's Lonnie. He's the owner and operator of the Boston Shaker, the craft cocktail supply store in Somerville, Massachusetts. For recipes and more information about the cocktail and the books that Lonnie mentioned, you can visit our website, radioboston.org. Lonnie, thanks so much for coming in. Really appreciate it.
Happy holidays.
And also thank you to Radio Boston producers, Zoe Mitchell and Paris Alston. Guys, thanks for joining me.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chris.
That's Radio Boston's Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, and Zoe Mitchell. And they're joined by Lonnie Newbern. Lonnie is the owner and operator of the Boston Shaker, the craft cocktail supply store in Somerville, Massachusetts. And that closes our special hour of Radio Boston today. Radio Boston is produced by Jamie Bologna, Chris Siderick, Walter Wuthman, Amanda Beland, and Cynthia Betubiza. Marquise Neal is our technical director. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thank you for listening. Join us again Monday for more Radio Boston.